As you probably know, I made a second trip to Japan this summer and took a little time to study the present situation among the Japanese people relating to marriage and family life. I think some of the conclusions were interesting, and while we cannot say they would be entirely applicable here, I think they do make one point clear, namely, there can be more than one way of looking at a problem. We have always taken it for granted that our own solutions were the only ones, that we must struggle on to demonstrate the infallibility of whatever attitude we hold. In marriage among the Japanese people for the last 1800 years has been built upon an entirely different foundation from ours. The basic definition is that the purpose of marriage is that individuals shall slowly come together. That instead of a tremendous emotional impact, relationships should ripen slowly and gradually, so that through a lifetime, two persons who begin as strangers end as almost one person. This is the Japanese psychology of marriage. To attempt to bring about this end, they follow a procedure that was also prevalent in Europe until comparatively recently. Young people generally did not select marriage partners. This selection was a privilege of parents, grandparents, advisors, or priests. The idea being that it is impossible for young people to start out with the full experience of mature life. They cannot know as much at 20 as they're going to know at 40 or 50. Yet in a time of great emotional tension and almost no experience, they make decisions which are to last for their lives, or if they break up, are certain to leave devastating scars. The families, therefore, get together and pool their common knowledge of their children. Each family knows a good deal about its own children. It knows their tastes, their peculiar personalities, their attitudes, their ambitions. The parents are able to estimate very clearly the social proprieties of union, whether it is probable that these two persons will have sufficient common ground of appreciation or insight to make a success of a life together. Now, we must not assume, however, that the Japanese family forced its decision upon its children. This is not true. The parents did not require their children to marry the person selected. They recommended, but did not require. After it seemed that a suitable marriage partner had been found, the two young people were introduced to each other, and then had a period of 6 months or a year of social contact. They went out to the theater together. They dined. They enjoyed the scenery of the various seasons. They attended the festivals. They had considerable common knowledge of each other. And at the end of a prescribed time, either or both could express their feelings openly. And if they decided that it was not a suitable union, they were not forced to carry it on. Usually, however, in about 90% of cases, the union was accepted. First, because these young people had no other experience in life except that which was being formed for them. Furthermore, they had deep regard for their parents. They believed in the wisdom of the elders. They knew the danger of their own immature emotional pressures. And they felt that the parent was right in assuming that a deep compatibility of character and ability, these were more important than a powerful emotional association. The Japanese said very frankly, emotion lasts for a few hours or a few weeks or a few months, but a marriage should last for a lifetime. Therefore, it must be built upon the solid rock of common value. These young people must have spirit in common, soul interests in common. So assuming that the marriage was consummated, these young persons came together and created a home without any of the grand passion that dominates Western thinking. They respected each other. And the Japanese assume that mutual respect is the beginning of an enduring relationship. In the early years of marriage, it was the responsibility of both young persons to preserve this respect, to make sure that their conduct at all times appeared to be right and proper to the other person, that they maintained the integrities of their private and personal lives in a deep way, so that the other person would always approach them with courtesy and respect. Then came the children. And in the Japanese family, the children are the first great emotional outlet. The love for the children is no longer a passion concealed. It is no longer behind the no mask of proprieties. Parents in Japan adore their children. Businessmen rush home, take off their Western clothes, get into their kimono, and trot the children around the house on their backs. They love children. And the child's place in Japan is the most fortunate, perhaps of any place in the world. These children, however, also brought up within a strong bond of respect. One of the proprieties of the Japanese home is that never will the children see the parents disrespectful to each other. Never for one moment will parents take sides or force their children to. Never will parents say unpleasant things to each other in the presence of a child. Always the proprieties remain. And as the old Japanese matchmaker points out, where there are not these flaming passions of youth and adolescence, there are not so likely to be the flaring tempers, the hates, the quick grievances, and the sudden bitter words. Relationships are on an entirely different basis. Then gradually the children grow up. And after the children have passed through their early childhoods, then in the Japanese family, you begin to see father and mother growing together. You see them becoming more and more dependent on each other. Their facial expressions become similar. They become almost inseparable. They become almost psychically aware of each other, always with the same quiet faces, but always with a mysterious strength of simple, direct devotion. A simple admiration that has never been destroyed by disillusionment. A warmth that has become warmer, but never blazed into some terrible conflagration. So in the end of life, these two people really become almost one soul in two bodies. And when one passes on, the other nearly always follows in a short time. And when the posthumous Buddhist name of the dead is inscribed on the little stone in the temple cemetery, the name of the survivor is placed also on the same stone, for it will not be long. So that this is their way of solving problems. Now it is obvious that this way is under terrific bombardment at the present time. It is something that probably cannot survive into the future there any more than it could here. But there are still some points about it that are very well worth considering. There are facts and values in this relationship which has caused these people to say from the beginning, way back in the dawn of their history, that human relationships were important. They were never things to play with. They were never things to be taken lightly. The human heart is a most strange and subtle thing. It must be brought into a safe maturity. It must be taught always, not only its own value, but the importance of other hearts, and that no one shall break another heart. It's just not thinkable. So many of the Japanese and other Asiatic peoples have died of broken hearts themselves under certain conditions. But even then, they have seldom allowed others to see their pain. It is just not done. Everything is the courtesy of maintaining some form of value. I talked to a young woman who has graduated from the University of Kyoto and who is probably going to break away from the family tradition. To do it, she has to leave Japan. She's going to another country to continue her education. Because if she wishes to stay in Japan, she must face this traditional pattern. So I asked her what it all meant to her. Was she leaving because she wanted to pick her own husband somewhere? She said, no, that wasn't the real reason. The real reason was that at the time she just did not want to marry at all. She wanted to go on with her education. She wished to gain further knowledge and to become a teacher in one of the universities. A marriage would make this difficult, particularly if it was consummated in Japan. She was going to go away, but with her parents' blessing. They were not trying to prevent it. They sensed the new generation that was growing up. But they had taught her certain things. They said to her very simply, wherever you go, whoever you choose to marry, whenever you choose, think first of respect. Can you honestly say that this person is admirable? That this person is intellectually, morally, culturally your equal? Is this person one who has fine ideals, a good background to achieve in his own field? Will he be faithful? Will he be a good father? For a woman who marries a man without solving in her own heart whether that man will be a good father is making a serious mistake. These things must be thought through. And they must be thought through before tragedies come. For a lot of emotion and very little thought will add together to form disaster. So we leave that far side of the world for a moment and see what is happening on this rather disaster-ridden continent we live in. The situation in family life is not good. Family clinics working with these problems bring in some pretty sad stories. The American home is in poor condition. Now, there are many factors contributing to this poverty of values. One of the factors is the increasing self-centeredness of people. In the Western world, we are breeding a generation of individuals primarily concerned only with themselves. They are not deeply problemed by the needs of their neighbors. They are not tremendously willing to sacrifice any of their own interests for the survival of a common good. Wherever you have selfishness, you have potential disaster in human relationships. Another factor that has arisen in American life, perhaps a little earlier than this generation, but has fed into our time a number of destructive forces, is the calculated marriage. A marriage of some type of advantage. Now, in the canons of marriage in China and Japan, there is no reference whatsoever as to the desirability of marrying a rich husband. This is not considered as any part. And in selecting marriage mates, a wealthy family will probably not select an impoverished person, but will select one of their own status. And a family of moderate means will under no conditions marry into a wealthy family. They cannot overlook what Socrates said, that to marry wealth is to get a master, not a husband. These points are taken into consideration, but young people do not, for the most part, think of these things. And in our last generation, we had too many scheming parents striving desperately to make what they considered to be brilliant marriages for their children. In these brilliant marriages, no thought was given to values. No thought was given to character or ability or temperament. Most everything was centered upon advantage. I know a number of cases that have come to me of miserable persons who are the consequences of such parental advice. Their lives have been completely ruined. And for every dollar they got through a fortunate marriage, they had hours of pain and sorrow and finally of bad conscience. I've seen that work very definitely. In the American pattern as we have it today, we are not producing any clear insight into the marriage problem any more than we are producing it in nearly any other area of modern life. How many young people today are taught the real basic importance of marriage for mutual assistance? Marriage for true, enduring companionship. Marriage for improvement through cooperation. Marriage in order to provide a good, happy, normal, healthy, unselfish environment for the raising of children. These things are not taught, except in a very few areas. There are a few schools in which these principles are clearly stated, and the divorce rate among the graduates of these schools is much lower than the average. We are having a great many very early marriages these days, and marriages of teenagers that break up, and many do. Statistics would indicate that the greatest cause of the breakup is parental interference, not the misunderstandings or troubles of the young people. Someone has to get into the situation and cause a difficulty and trouble, and there's always someone ready to do so. We have the lack of responsibility, the lack of integrities, the lack of realization. All these things arising from lack of experience. The young person simply has not yet a sufficient knowledge of the kind of world in which he is going to live. He does not understand the inner guidances which become the basis of the development and maturing of human character. So we can say, looking over the problem, that in homes at the present time, crimes are committed every day, crimes that will never be punished. And that individuals treat their own relatives far worse than they would dare to treat strangers. If you steal from a stranger, you will go to jail. If you steal from your relatives, they are expected to forgive you and perhaps give you a bonus. The relationships in families are such that mutual imposition is among the most common problems of the day. Also, we find that these families are composed of persons who are undisciplined as individuals. They have never thought for a moment of sacrificing themselves. They have developed the code of sacrificing other people to their own desires, and they do this generously. They expect in marriage to have all the freedoms that they had without marriage. They expect in no way to feel any restraint upon their actions. Our mental hospitals today are loaded with neurotics, whose neuroses have resulted from the fact that having raised families, they cannot continue to do exactly as they please. They have to give up or sacrifice something. And there are cases of individuals who have had nervous breakdowns and have committed suicide at the horrible necessity of remaining at home with their own children. For some reason, we are not producing the kind of young people who recognize the importance of sharing the values of life. Now, there are some who feel that marriage is done for, as far as Western man is concerned. But these have not taken into consideration the basic biological pressures which are within man. Nor have they taken into full account that man and all his tribe are part of a great natural plan of things which has its own purposes. And one of these purposes is that the individual shall come to that degree of inner insight in which he can share and to at least a degree modify his own selfishness. The purpose of nature is cooperation, whereas in human nature we see too much of competition. So nature is not going to permit marriage to cease entirely. But it is going to force the individual to recognize that there are rules governing marriage as there are in every other area of life. To break these rules is to suffer, regardless of our own arrogance or our own sophistication. To ignore these rules is to suffer. Peace and happiness comes only through obeying the rules governing the area of life under consideration. So, the rules governing marriage have a reason for their existence. Nature has produced two distinct types of human beings, one we call male and the other female. They are not the same kind of being in two kinds of bodies. Man is not man because of physical gender. He is man because of psychological integration. The same is true of woman. She is not woman because she is in a feminine body. She is woman because she has a feminine psychic integration. Each of these integrations is in some way polarized. There is a truth behind all these things which we cannot deny. And that is that neither man nor woman is truly complete. Some can achieve more of completeness than others. There are some who are certainly, by psychic temperament, not suited for domestic living. But in the great majority of instances, nature has set up this polarization for a reason. What nature wishes to do is to broaden and deepen the psychic life of the human being. Man is deeply within his own nature, androgynous. Within the depths of his own psychic integration, he is also both male and female. But one part of his nature is submerged. And in man, the anima is subjective. In woman, the animus is subjective. Each is therefore seeking complement, seeking completion. and also confronted with one of the great opportunities which nature provides for the enlargement of consciousness. All relationships are successful when they contribute to understanding. And one of the great purposes of our associations in life, one of these purposes is understanding, enrichment, the gradual development of a more perfect inner selfness than we could otherwise experience. Thus, in the course of time, male and female beings are brought together for the purpose not only of generating the species, but of regenerating themselves. And both experiences are involved in this relationship. Each is seeking to release a psychic experience which enriches and perfects and ennobles. Yet this cannot be achieved unless the submerged parts are brought forth by sympathy. We cannot be forced into any relationship with life. We cannot be compelled to like or dislike. We must experience all of these things from within ourselves, according to our own natures and needs. But there can be no doubt that marriage is a great opportunity for growth. And growth is the reason for life. If man was created to be happy, the plan has been a dismal failure. But if man was created to grow and given the right to have happiness as a byproduct of accepted growth, then he still has a tremendous project before him, a tremendous potential achievement. Then, the family. What is the family? The family is a group of persons bound together by blood or marriage, which is a kind of social unit, a little commonwealth. Confucius had much to say concerning the family. He declared it to be the microcosm of the state. And he pointed out very clearly that as goes the family, so goes the nation. And that no nation has ever survived the breakdown of its homes. The family is the most intimate area of consciousness by which we become aware of life. The child growing up first experiences life as in the family. These first experiences leave deep etchings upon the psychic nature of the child. And the child that enjoys the security of a family has an experience to pass on to its children, which is rich and important and all-powerful in the framing of future generations. The family, then, is actually a mature responsibility to be assumed with thoughtfulness, even with prayerfulness. Certainly never for the sole purpose of gratifying physical propensities. To the degree that we think of family only in terms of physical gratification of physical impulses and urges, to that degree we are destroying the family life of our nation. This does not mean that we shall eliminate or ignore the sexual factor in marriage. But marriage built upon sex is a failure to start with, because it cannot hold. It will lead to promiscuity. It will result in tragedy. I think we must finally come back to the original Oriental thought. The true foundation of marriage is mutual respect, in which each person is keenly aware of the unusual characteristics of the other and is proud of those characteristics in that other person and wishes to help them to develop to even greater manifestation. A marriage must be built upon a sincere desire for mental, emotional, psychological comradeship. Under such conditions, physical associations complement and complete the union. But without overtone, these physical things fail and always have failed. And when we realize the situation as it is in America today, we have to realize that marriage is not suitable for young people who consider it merely a form of action, merely an opportunity to vent some tremendous pent-up emotional urge. Marriage is not merely an emotional experience. Marriage is the consummation and culmination of a plan, a purpose which nature has held from time immemorial. It must either help to advance man, or it must tear down and destroy the noblest part of man's nature. Today, the majority of homes are bad. They may not be broken, some of them cannot break, simply because of religious restrictions. Others do not break because of numerous factors, financial, social, and otherwise. But the majority of homes are not being held together by mutual respect. The individuals in these homes are not there because of all places on earth that is where they most want to be. And to prove this, they are not at home any more than possible. The home is very largely a hotel for these people. And they do not even have the advantage anymore of two being able to live cheaper than one. The beginning of our whole situation is this mutual respect factor. Now, people come to me every day. I've had them with several of them within the last few weeks, whose entire concept of marriage is wrong. One individual says, "I married because I did not want to live alone." A very poor excuse. Because the individual this person married was the one that then lived alone for the rest of their lives. There was no companion. The only thing that this person wanted was something to listen to, complaints, to defend and protect, to comfort and be present. And as a reward for this, the individual agreed to accept these privileges without too much resistance. There was no basic comradeship of purpose. Another individual married simply because they didn't want to cook their own meals. Older people marry because they can't afford servants. So they marry one sometimes, to everyone's disaster. Some marry for wealth, for position. Some marry for envy and revenge. But wherever these motives come in, you have miserable people. And I think we can say without any question in the world that of all human relationships, marriage is the most dangerous if any ulterior motives are present. This is one area where ulterior motives are fatal. Now, occasionally you find people who almost brag of their ulterior motives. They wish to be very modern and very brittle about the whole thing. They do not wish to have any deep, serious roots in anything, so far as marriage is concerned. They do not want to be hurt, and they are going to protect themselves desperately against the possibility of being hurt. They get nowhere either. They are hurt in spite of themselves, and they must stand by and hurt others and see it happen, because you cannot play lightly with these facts. If, therefore, if we are going to do anything about this problem that is important at all, I think we're going to have to get right down to the educational level with these people. Perhaps what is necessary is that every individual applying for a marriage license must either produce a certificate that they have made a reasonable study in an accredited institution of marriage, or make that study before the marriage is consummated. If every young person was either given some of these values in school or required to possess them before marriage, we could do a great deal more to curb this situation. We do not at the present time license an automobile driver without some test into the ability of this person to drive a car. At least we give them a sanity test. We do not do this in connection with marriage. We assume that these persons know what they want, and if they are successful in passing a test for venereal disease, they get the license. This is the only consideration. This will not solve our present problem. It did solve the problem to a measure when parents and families were close, when people lived in a comparatively simple environment and pressures were not as great as they are now. But today, marriage is a much more difficult and treacherous undertaking. It is not a problem of trying to prevent it. The problem is to try to prevent marriage from filling our mental institutions with the byproducts of its mistakes. I think that perhaps every person who marries should be required to at least listen, whether they want to or not, to a simple statement of the principles of marriage. Perhaps be supplied with some kind of a small booklet or brochure and then be examined on it, to know that at least they have received some basic insight. Whether they make use of it or not is hard to say, but they should not be permitted to go on in life not knowing that there are rules, and continuing on through the years without the slightest suspicion that they are making their own lives miserable for everyone around them. One of the difficulties that we find today particularly is, of course, the reaction from the general pressured existence that we live. More and more, we are becoming nervous wrecks. Some think we are suffering from air pollution, others from water pollution, and a great many are beginning to suspect that we are suffering from educational pollution, that we are not being taught the right things, that we are not being directed in the ways which are necessary to our well-being. In any event, the average person today is half sick from the pressure of life. In a home composed of individuals who are half sick and three-quarters selfish, there is not very much defense or support. The home is no longer a place of refuge against the world. The home is merely the continuation of the public feud. The home is no longer security, integrity, value, where people can honestly be themselves. It is now an area of defenses, of a very carefully prepared strategy in which each member of the family is struggling desperately to gain some subtle advantage for himself. The home then is not helping to support the life of the people. The home that is beyond the means of the owner, where debt is hanging heavy, where people are struggling desperately to be happy by surrounding themselves with luxuries that they cannot afford and do not need, must ultimately awake to the fact that none of these luxuries are contributing anything to happiness. But the person today is so nervous and so tense that he cannot relax that he cannot enjoy life, that he cannot quietly contemplate value. He must be continuously in a state of agitation or intensity. When this happens in home life, everyone is in trouble. I have people coming to me every day telling stories of cruelty, unkindness, thoughtlessness in home life. Practically every common vice that we thought we had outgrown is back with us in full force, because we have lost nearly all the graciousness of living. Now, if you are in a situation which involves some unhappiness in home patterns, there are a few things that perhaps everyone can bear in mind. I think the Oriental is right in his attitude that he should first examine himself to see what he may be contributing to the stress of the situation. In home patterns, each individual helps or hurts. There are very few who are actually neutral. So if things are not happy with you, what are you doing that is wrong? Are you trying to force situations that are not right? Are you too ambitious? Are you selfish? Or are you simply one of those countless persons who cannot control themselves? The most common excuse that we hear these days after a family feud is that the individual will simply say, "Well, I just can't help it. I was tired, I was irritated, so I flared up," and that's that. Well, an occasional flare-up may be forgiven. But as these things become more and more frequent, we have to realize a simple Greek axiom, namely that every time we expose a bad part of ourselves to anyone else, we destroy something of that other person's respect for us. You cannot prevent it. You cannot hold affection if you are hateful. You cannot expect other people to overlook all your faults and applaud all your virtues, any more than you are willing to overlook all the faults of other people and recognize only their virtues. The gradual building up of minor irritations, not controlled, exhibited unwisely, will ultimately completely destroy human relationships. For these relationships, as Confucius pointed out, are built upon dignity. And dignity is an individual so well controlling himself that he will not do or say anything that undermines the natural respect to which he is entitled. Confucius, therefore, coined the concept of the superior man. And in family, what is a superior person, whether man or woman? A superior person is one, as Confucius said, by nature so endowed that they have become incapable of an inferior action. Not that they control it, but that they are incapable of it. Now, an inferior action is any action which puts the individual in a bad light to himself or to others. An inferior action is to reveal to another person that you are not as fine a person as they think you are, or as you have given others to believe you to be. A person who is regarded as noble exhibits a sudden flare of jealousy or envy or petty larceny, and this shows them not to be superior persons. Well, they will say, and many have said to me, "So what? I'm not a superior person. I'm not trying to be. I want what I want. I'm going to say what I think. I'm going to do what I feel like doing." Years later, that person comes back and they say to me, "Why am I lonely? Why has everyone deserted me? Why do fates turn against me? Why have I lost the respect of my children?" The answer is almost always the individual has lost these better things simply because he was resolved to do as he pleases. And what he pleases to do is not right. So we cannot allow ourselves to deteriorate within our own natures and then expect good things to happen. They will not happen. So Confucius gives us a pretty good key to what might be termed a person of character. A person of character is one who instinctively protects the happiness of others. The person of character will injure no one for any reason. The person of character will neither slander nor gossip or carry ill report of anyone. The person of character, if they come upon someone whose conduct they do not regard as proper, will bow out, but they will not condemn. The person of character will meet every responsibility with a full spirit, assuming the greatest honor to be that of fulfilling completely what is necessary and evading and avoiding nothing. The person of character will always be available in time of need, will always be a strong rock, and will always be willing to sacrifice personal happiness for greater causes. The person of character is attempting to follow heaven, to be like deity. For deity is eternally patient of all things. Deity never corrects anyone with a whip. As Graciano says, deity corrects all things with time. Time is the weapon of deity. Time is also the weapon of the wise man. For if he maintains his own integrities, time will justify him. If he does not, time will undo him. So in all things, we must so act that time will prove us. We have to think only in long-range policy. When we are working with our children, we must always say to ourselves, time will pass. As I treat these children now, so must I face the consequences 10, 20, 30 years from now. Now that long time off seems distant and remote today, but it comes more quickly than we suspect. And wherever we find unhappiness in families, we find it richly deserved. People have been selfish. They have tried to hope that they could be happy without communicating happiness to those around them. Now, in family problems also today, there are many situations that arise from conditions that our ancestors knew very little about. One, of course, is the increasing education. Well, most families today are composed of educated persons. Many marriages are between college graduates. It is not impossible that both will hold doctorates. These persons, through their education, have come to visualize the value of their own purposes. They are career conscious. Most of all, perhaps, they are convinced that each has a good mind, a mind good enough to have equality with all other minds. But in our problem, it is not so much the equality of minds that seems to be the trouble. as it is that these minds always see themselves as superior rather than equal. So we have mental competition very strongly marked in families, and also a reluctance to sacrifice career for family life, so that young marriages today are very often built upon the hope that this career can be sustained, and that these young people are no longer mentally and emotionally adjusted to the ordinary problems of domestic existence. They wish to continue to be rugged individualists, with marriage perhaps as a convenience, perhaps intended well enough, but with very little intimation of self-sacrifice. Intellectual marriage has its difficulties, but it may also have very great advantages. An intellect is not bad, but an intellect which leads us merely to arrogance is very bad. I think that one of the problems that we have here can be summed up in this way. All things being equal, the educated person of today is not what we might term maturely enlightened. Education has been the transmission of traditional knowledge. And these two young people, both of whom have graduated with honors, are stuffed with intellectual notions. They have graduated, perhaps equipped, according to our standards, to turn around and teach others. Perhaps they are equipped to make excellent careers for themselves, independent of the assistance of a marital partner. But actually, these young people starting out are for the most part profoundly ignorant. They are ignorant of value. They have mistaken intellectualism for life. And there is nothing in the college course that they have taken which really fits them to live together in cooperation as human beings. Actually, their humanity has been damaged rather than advanced. They have come to the condition in which they have substituted intellectualism for true achievement. Thus, they can go out and have careers, and they can be successful in them. And the young lady may end as the dean of women in one of our largest universities. But all through this process, she is not going to be happy. There are going to be moments that will be extremely difficult for her. There will also be a frustration within herself, which in the majority of instances leads to trouble. Occasionally, the person adapts to such a life with real serenity of spirit, but for the most part, they do not. Or actually, what nature wants is a warm protection of life. What nature is looking for continuously is a better future generation. Nature wants those of this generation to bring into this world and rear to maturity better people than live today. Progress depends upon this. The future of the world does not depend upon a Phi Beta Kappa or anything of that nature. The future of the world depends upon bringing in intelligent, emotionally stable young people who grow up to their maturity with right ideals, right principles, and right convictions about values. So what each generation must bring into the world is a wiser generation than itself. And it cannot do this by simply leaving the younger generation to its own providences. It cannot ignore these young people or turn them over to babysitters or allow them to grow up the best they can in contentious atmospheres and produce this thing that nature demands: the better generation to come. A generation emotionally stable. A generation less susceptible to pride. A generation less likely to compromise principles for advantage. What we must try always to do is to produce true nobility of character, true integrity of life. To the degree that any young family today fails in this task or compromises this task for its own advantage now, that family will suffer. Those people will suffer. The homes will break up. And when the time comes, we will know what it is to have a thankless child. But actually, the child is thankless because it has nothing to be thankful for. It has been deprived of value. Comenius, the father of education, pointed out that the beginning of education is that children shall learn love, honor, respect, and integrity from the knee of the parents, from infancy, and most of all from constant example.